Hey, hi everyone. Welcome to Choice Podcast, Life and Business in Asia. One of the good things of starting this podcast is that I'm making new connections. They can be with new people or connecting with people I already know in a different way. Most of my podcast guests I know personally, but the guest in today's show is new for me as well. Nevertheless, his entrepreneurial story is too interesting and intriguing to not share with you all. Bernard Hoare is a Malaysian entrepreneur with Chinese roots who has been involved in different businesses and companies in Asia. Bernard's journey as an entrepreneur started early on in his own surroundings, and this mentality led to starting a business in Korea, which he brought to Southeast Asia, and today he's the co-founder and group CEO of Hatio, a Southeast Asia-based supply chain cloud software provider. The Southeast Asian market is relatively young when it comes to e-commerce and high-technology warehousing solutions, and for Bernard, it is a no-brainer that it will grow. He would like to support this growth by providing affordable but advanced digital solutions and develop local talents. He has thought a lot about life and business and is so generous in sharing his insights and experience, so it was very interesting to learn from him. Let's dive right in to learn more about this industry in Southeast Asia and Korea through Bernard's experience. Hey, hi Bernard, good to have you here. How are you?
Hi Choi, good morning. Doing good here. How are you doing?
I'm doing well as well, luckily. I'm in Hong Kong. Where are you?
I'm currently in Malaysia. I'm currently in Kuala Lumpur. Yeah, Malaysia is good. Over here is good because we're about 95% vaccinated right now.
Oh, so
the economy is open up. Yeah, we are easing into the endemic phase. So the virus is here to stay, right? This is it. So I think we are easing into the endemic phase. Economy is open up. Our borders are also starting to open up as well.
Yeah, tell us a bit about yourself and your business.
I'm a father of two boys, 7 and 5. The names are Zachary and Thaddeus. And I live by the mantra of happy wife, happy life. And the irony is that my wife is also my business partner. So we've been in this for the last 11 years. Ever since we're dating. A little bit more personal about myself. I'm also the co-founder of Hatio. We are a South Korean-based business. We were started and founded in Korea in 2012. And we're in the technology space for supply chain and logistics.
You're not that, based on your appearance, I can safely say that you're not that old, but you're already an entrepreneur. Is it always something that you always wanted to be?
So if I were to look at where I started as an entrepreneur, of course, my mom always liked to say that my entrepreneurship journey started when I was in high school. And there was one year where the haze was very bad. We had like in Malaysia, we had like the one of the worst haze situation ever in that year when I was 16. And I was, one of the things that I did pretty fast was I sold masks to my classmates. So I just went to the pharmacy, bought a couple of boxes of masks, and then I sold it by the pieces. Every piece, I think I earned about 20 cents, 30 cents. It's enough to buy me an hour of in a cyber cafe, shooting away in Counter-Strike. But I think really where it all started really was one day when I was still back home, and there was one afternoon, one evening, I saw one of my neighbors coming back. He's not really old, but a middle-aged man. He came back. And he emerged from his car and he came down with a box. And as he came down, he looks really upset, really down. And I, being the bubbly kid I was, I went to him and said, "Hey, look, hi, you're home early." So I was the kid that moves around in my area and I know who comes back at what time. So I said, "Hey, uncle, you're back early." And he's, "Yeah, young man." And he's like really down and he just told me one thing. I didn't even ask him anything. I didn't ask him, like, "How's your day?" And he just went ahead and he just went and said, "Young man, remember this." I was like, wow. I was 17 at the time, I think. And whatever that he said didn't make sense to me. And he says, "Young man, remember this. The future is very uncertain and you have to chart your own future." So really, when you tell that to a 17-year-old, what the hell? I was like, okay. And then he just walked away. I didn't quite understand what happened and what he was saying until a little while later, a few years later, then I discovered more of myself, what I wanted to do. And I remember back that day. And that day was the day he got retrenched. It was circa that area, that that year where the economy was slowed down and he got retrenched. He was one of those high paying guys, got retrenched, living a high life, and everything just turned 360. Everything just turned upside down in a blink of an eye overnight. And he, I won't say that he lost everything, but I think he lost the lifestyle that he was already living. And that was what he told me. So I remember so clearly, young man, chart your own future. Don't get into the whole uncertainty of a 9-to-5. It makes sense a few years later as I charted out my own future. I think I really listened to his advice, I believe. So that was it. And I started, I started was really when I was in my second year of university. And we, together with a couple of friends, we started our first business. If you ask me what business was there, seriously, is now that I look back, it's very difficult to actually define that business, because let me tell you what we're doing in that business. We're doing events, because it was very easy for university kids to be in events and PR. We were offering swim classes. So we made quite a bit from swimming classes. We were offering tuition classes. We were at one point in time offering sporting events. So we did almost like every other thing under the roof, so long as we have our energy allows us to. But that was a good start, because that was really a start of no return. And since then, I've never, I did some part-time job during the university days, during the breaks. But even during those part-time jobs, we were still running our business. And yeah, it was, I've never looked back. And it was just all the way. They say once you're an entrepreneur, you know, it never leaves you. Once it finds you, it gets to you. It's very difficult to get out of it. So yeah, that was how it all started.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. You really started early on. And from there, what's the rest of the story? So in university, you were organizing events.
Yeah. So we thought we could make it big. I think every 20-year-old who started a business would always think that, you know, they make it big. And at that time, we don't even know the word entrepreneurship. We don't even know what the hell unicorn was, right? Unicorn was just a colorful animal that could fly. And then as we moved on, many years later, I met my partner and we started a youth marketing agency where we were basically providing the youth market intelligence and consultations to brands, particularly the mobile brands and the fast-moving consumer goods, the retail brands. So we've got a really good run there, and across about three to five years down the line, we exited that business. Some of our markets got acquired, and then we exited that business and we moved, and we had a chance. That was when we had an opportunity to move into and explore the technology space. So it was, technology space then was really about website development, you know, and then of course, mobile apps was like a big thing, starting to get to be a big thing. And we went into mobile app development. And before we know it, everybody out there were doing mobile app development and website development. But that was where the technology point started. And also around that point, I met my wife, then girlfriend. And she was still in college. Yeah, so I was dating a college girl. She was still in college. And I think they say when you meet the right one. So it was very natural as well. Even in college, she was helping us in our technology business, youth marketing agency. We were doing stuff. And I guess that really builds the bond. And then what happened was we started to get more and more serious, not only in our relationship, but also in the business. And we started to really go into the whole, and we started to get really serious clients. We didn't have a lot of clients. We didn't want to run a big team, but we were selective on who we work with. So at one point in time, we were working with a major telco provider here. We were working with a major healthcare group, and all these guys are all public listed companies. We were also at one point in time working with the guys from Nokia, from Google. So these things drives us, and I think it builds the character in us as entrepreneurs. That's how it all came. And then at one point in time, we were in Korea. And this is where it all started with Hatio. So we were having a trip in Korea. And then that's where I met my co-founders in Seoul. And yeah, we just clicked. And then at that time, that was when the story of Hatio started, with how we wanted to bring Hatio to Southeast Asia. So that was how it all pieced together till the point today.
Yeah, and clicked with your co-founders because you were already having an entrepreneurial background with technical experience. Mm-hmm. And you were coming from Malaysia, so you also had the Southeast Asian market advantage.
Yeah.
And your co-founder, they had an existing business or existing business model, and then you created something together. Is that how I should picture
it? Yeah. So what happened was I eventually found myself as my position as I was in Korea, and I found the position, my own position, as the Southeast Asian kid. So I was like the Southeast Asian guy. Mm-hmm. And there was like a huge effort to help South Korean businesses and startups to explore into a new region. And Southeast Asia was a key region for the South Korean government as well. So that was where we took the advantage of it. And yeah, and we expanded our market footprint in Southeast Asia. And we create entirely a new business unit out of what we already have existingly in Hatyo. So it was really a whole experience of Hatyo that we've been doing in South Korea in terms of the distribution and the warehousing, in the logistics and supply chain space. And we took all those capabilities and took it to Southeast Asia and to help the local SMEs in Southeast Asia to move into the digitization phase. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But I think that in the beginning, you also needed to really guide your customers, your clients into the product that you were actually selling.
So here's what's really interesting, right, Troy? When we came to Southeast Asia, when we expanded to Southeast Asia, we do not even have a product on hand. There was no product. There was zero product. I remember we late 2018, when we make that decision, the leadership of Hatyo, when we make the decision to expand and leave our comfort zone in Korea, then we came here and that's where I remember we took about 4 to 5 months where we traveled around Southeast Asia. We were in Bangkok, Vietnam, Manila, Singapore, of course, and then, of course, Malaysia. And we spoke to we were having conversations with a lot of the local small, medium enterprises. We were very focused. We're having all these conversations with them and we were learning. We were basically empathizing, what's the challenge of digitization and from the cost perspective, from the market perspective, from the volume perspective. And as we have more and more in these conversations, we learned that the whole idea was not to have a ready product and try to sell to them. But the whole idea was to first begin to understand their predicaments, their challenges, and the why is to understand the why of how things are done in Southeast Asia currently in this market. And I remember our first two clients in Southeast Asia, client 001 and 002, bought a product from us before we even have the product. So they actually bought a warehouse management solution from us before we even have any warehouse management solution. Because now back in Korea, we're doing a lot of automation, robotics, warehouse controls, warehouse executions, but we never had a warehouse management software. So when we came to Southeast Asia and we started understanding and we were having these conversations, and I think these conversations built the trust and the confidence over time, over a very short period of time. And that's where the local guy, I remember the first local guy here says, "Hey, look, I agree to with you guys, build me the warehouse management software." And that's how it all started. And we say, hey, look, yeah, this became an opportunity for us to basically create something that would potentially, and is what happened, that's what's happening right now, that is actually helping more and more warehouse operators in the Southeast Asia market. And today we are basically working with the 3PL, the third-party logistics warehouse operators. We are working with the retailers and we're working with the distributors as well. And it all started by a simple act of first trying to understand the market, what's going on, what's happening, and not first trying to sell a product like what most of people would do. So that was how our experience with Southeast Asia was.
But yeah, your research in the beginning where you try to find out what the problems were in practice, these companies, they are just talking to you maybe in the hope that you would provide a solution. They were happy to spend time.
So the first group of clients, the first group of people that we spoke to, of course, I will admit that it was with the what was in the mind was to sell them, right? Was to sell them a service, was to sell them a solution that we have, right? We have experience doing. And I remember when we spoke about all this automation and robotics and Internet of Things, and these local SMEs in Southeast Asia, they were very excited listening to all these things. But the moment we went to the point of price, of cost, That was like the end of the conversation. So that was when it hits me and it hits the team and they're like, why? But and we're like, okay, let's take a different approach. Instead of trying to tell them all this cool stuff that we're doing and trying to sell it to them and say, if you implement this in your warehouse or in your logistics space, this is what you can. Instead of trying to do that, let's switch gears. So we shift our gears. And instead of trying to talk from the product point of view, we say, let's go and just say, hey, look, help us understand what you're going through.
Yeah.
Help us understand. Why are you using pen and paper? Why are you still operating and managing your inventory out of Microsoft Excel spreadsheets? Nothing wrong with Excel spreadsheets.
Yeah.
It does what it does. It works. But why are you still there, right? Or why are you using accounting systems to manage your warehouse inventories, right? So we wanted to understand the why. So I think when we really went in strong from the perspective of why, we realized that people were actually, the local guys were actually more open.
It's trying to find a solution that, you're trying to help each other or you're...
And we also felt what the response that we're getting also felt very much, wow, this is the first time somebody is like, this is the first time... These companies, these software companies are here, not selling to us, but they're just asking why and what's happening and what's going on. And they're trying to understand, right? So people were very open, right? People were very open. They were telling us a lot of stuff. I remember every warehouse that we go to, we spent not 1 hour of pitch, but we spent hours in there talking to these guys. The number of, you know, and I always tell this experience to a lot of people, is especially in Malaysia, and the amount of bak kut teh meals that I have to go through, sitting down with all these local SMEs, Chinamen, they will always buy you the bak kut teh meal, and they will talk. But that it is through those bak kut teh meals that they will tell you about their problems and all that. Of course, it will always end with, but then, what can you do for us, right? Then that's where I don't have anything for you.
But looking backwards, that is, sounds relaxed story and a good opportunity, but you must have felt a lot of pressure as well. You're trying to start something and you have co-founders who have expectations and you're not really certain what your additional value is and if you're going to get business out of it. And then you're like allowing yourself to spend hours on it. It's not an easy decision. It's not an easy phase. So you have to believe, I think, or...
I think that is where it's true when they say as entrepreneurs, you thrive in uncertainty. When the situation is like super extreme uncertain, that's where we thrive. I think the one thing that happens is that when the situation becomes too certain, like everything is like well prepared, arranged, and what's going to happen, then I think for entrepreneurs it's like that. It's a big risk, right? Because then we tend to get too comfortable too fast. But when it's uncertain, it keeps you going. It keeps you awake at night. It kicks you out of bed and it's like, shit, why is this so still uncertain? What can I do for these guys? And that's where you keep bringing it to the table, keep going back to the drawing boards with the co-founders. I remember we went back to the drawing board again and again through that whole 5-6 months, and we're like, what can we do? On one hand, things that we've been doing in Korea and in China has been very automation. It's like high investment stuff. So this stuff is not going to cut it here. So on the other hand, these guys are not digitized and they need help somewhere. So what can we do? How can we bridge this with our capabilities and what the market needs?
Yeah.
Of course, I think what they call it in the startup term is called the product market fit, if there's something that I'm learning correctly. But really, it's how... So those are the mentality, those are the basically the mindsets, those are basically the thinking process, the thought process that has been driving us, I remember during that time, right? What can we do? Very uncertain, you're right, but I think it's also that uncertainty that really drives us and that uncertainty of a market makes us, help us look at Southeast Asia as a super exciting market. It's a 600 million people market. It's the market where e-commerce... records one of the fastest growth if you compare region to region, right? So what can we do? How can we be part of the tsunami wave, the wave that's coming in? How can we ride on top of the wave and win this market by helping and just by listening and helping what we can do for the local SMEs?
Yeah, because what you had in Korea was way too advanced for the companies.
That's right.
in yeah Yeah, and even in China, I think most in Korea was most advanced, and then comes China, and then Southeast Asia.
Yeah, yes. So if you look at the reports of these Gartners and the likes of Gartners, Korea has always been, and I think they're very consistent in being one of the world's most innovative economies, side by side with economies like Sweden, and even China, if you were to put China into the picture. But Korea has always been one of the most world's innovative economies, and they're one of the very few advanced nations in Asia. So while that is good, but that also means that cost in Korea is always very high. Yeah. So that's where I remember when we decided on the Southeast Asian market, and when we decided to say, okay, let's plant our flag here. Let's start the rock and roll in Southeast Asia. The first immediate blocker for us was cost. Mm. How do we, because, and I always use this metaphor, right? What we've been doing in Korea, I always tell my co-founders this. I said, look, guys, what we've been doing in Korea is like a BMW i8, a super i8 BMW. But right now, if you were to come to Southeast Asia, Southeast Asia can't afford the i8. But they want the i8. So what can we do? So it's all about the motivation, right? I know cost is expensive. And I remember putting this to the challenge in one of our earlier discussions about Southeast Asia. And I say, look, what we're going to do is we're going to bring that BMW i8 that we've been building and we've been doing out in our South Korean markets. And we're going to bring this whole i8 to Southeast Asia, and we're going to sell it at a Toyota price. Yeah, I remember everybody looking at me like, you must be joking, Bernard. And I remember my co-founder, Mr. Nam, and he looked at me, and without an hesitation, he says, Bernard, let's do it. All in. I remember these two keywords, all in. Let's go to Southeast Asia, bring what the capabilities that we have and this whole thing called the BMW i8, bring it to Southeast Asia and sell it at a Toyota price. The whole idea was not to sell cheap, but the whole idea is to make it affordable so that the market can get on the bandwagon of digitization. So hence our mandate, and that has become, that basically spells out and became our mandate, our key core mandate for Southeast Asia, for Hatio, which is helping local SMEs digitize. And that's so simple, and that's what we want to do. And that has basically been the key mandate mantra that has been carrying us through this, like what you said, uncertain periods, right? Of building a product, going to the market, what sales is going to be like. Yeah.
Great that you were so supported by your co-founder in this respect. Yeah.
Yeah.
He sounds like a true entrepreneur as well.
He is. He's the guy. Oh, by the way, when I say Mr. Nam, a lot of people will have picture, you know, startups like us and young co-founders. Mm. Mr. Nam is like a fatherly figure to us. Mr. Nam is 56. I'm not sure if he's going to be unhappy if I reveal his age here, but who cares? But he's 56. And when you have a 56-year-old co-founder with you, there's a lot of value in it. Yeah. Because it's not just a bunch of young guys trying to be the flying colorful horse called the unicorn. It's about building a profitable business. It's about don't raise money you do not need. It's about creating a good culture. It's about discipline. It's about how do you embed and create and mold the character of each and every one in the company. Yeah. So there's a lot of these kind of things that we discussed. And Mr. Nam is also the guy that his last company was actually acquired by Samsung prior to starting Hatio. So he's seen it all. I would say that he's seen it all. He's been through one cycle. And yeah, now we're basically very blessed to be tapping on his experience and his wisdom. Yeah.
Great. Yeah. And what is the size of your company now today?
We're at 25 people in our sole office. We are currently about 20 in our Malaysian office. We are expected, we forecast we're going to grow double in size this year for our Southeast Asian market. So a lot of focus for Hatio, a lot of focus is currently in Southeast Asia business unit. So we're going to grow in size moving forward. And we are also moving we are already stepping into our key markets in Philippines, in Indonesia, and Singapore as well. Yeah.
Okay, exciting. And are you planning to adapt your product, your services to each different market? Because I could imagine that the need will be there different as well.
Yeah. So I think there's two ways to look at it. One is that you're right that the need is different if you look at it in a very hyper-localized manner. But at the same time, because of how this whole logistics and supply chain space has basically evolved, especially over the last 18 to 20 months, thanks to COVID. And there's just a lot of M&A going on, right? There's a lot of merger and acquisition going on within the 3PL space. And right now, the kind of conversations we're having with our clients are, and how we got the opportunity, right? To move into these new markets was really, it's basically a business, right? One of our clients is a business that is in the 3PL and they basically are, existingly they have their businesses in Malaysia. And right now they're basically expanding their businesses through M&As to Indonesia and to Singapore. So for us, now they're coming back to us and says, hey, look, for Indonesia and Singapore, we would like to have the same technology there. And so Bernard, go ahead and deploy in our key markets. So that's how, and that's where we saw the real opportunity to quickly move into these markets, right?
Yeah.
So that's one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is also like what you said, rightfully put it, when we look at it from the hyper-local manner and from the operational point of view, it might be different. But then again, if you look at logistics, if you look at, let's just say you take for example, the warehouse. For warehousing, whether you're in the Philippines market, Indonesia or Vietnamese or even in the Malaysian market, in the warehouse space, it's always inbound, outbound, right? So there's not really much of a rocket science to it. And I believe the opportunity is not so much of a tool of a system of technology, but is the opportunity to provide best practices and standardized the best practices across the key markets. And I think that's what's going to open us up for Hartio. That's what's going to open us up to a bigger opportunity, to a bigger point of view than just a software seller. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And until now, what is the most challenging, difficult part? The commercial part or finding the right people, investors? Yeah, of course. The development of what is needed in the market, as you said, that was also a challenge.
I think the biggest challenge for us is going to market. The biggest challenge wasn't really investors. Wasn't really investment. The biggest challenge was really going to market. Because if you look at Southeast Asia, although Southeast Asia has always been looked at as one, right? You look at America as one. And then you look at Southeast Asia, the ASEAN countries, and you look at a lot of people will look at ASEAN as one, 600 million people, exciting, fast growing, very young consumers. But I think that's where it also, because every Southeast Asian countries is basically very much driven by the culture, by the different culture that each country has. And I think that's where the challenge is, because going to market is like what a lot of people say, there's no one size fit all. And I think this become really true and become very challenging when you look at it from the cultural point of view. So going to market in the culture, in the Indonesian market, is not as easy or not necessarily easy or hard, but it's totally different when you approach this Singapore market. The Singapore market, the culture will be different. Indonesia, it's very hyper-localized. And then when you come to Malaysia, it's also another different kind of culture. So I think going to market becomes a very big challenge. Hence, what we have been really trying really hard, and I wouldn't be shy to admit that it's also pretty much a struggle for us, is to find the right local partners.
Yeah.
Is to engage and to build that relationship. Yeah. So that's basically our biggest challenge currently. Yeah. It's not investment. It's not so much of product development. It's not engineering. It's really going to market.
Yeah, clear. Yeah. I was just indeed wondering if these cultural differences are so, or the mark specifics are so relevant, then you must need local support, and find these local partners is challenging. Yeah, I can totally imagine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, you're in the warehousing and distribution industry. Yeah. What have you seen? You're saying like in the last 2 years, there's a lot of M&A happening. What else is interesting for us to know about any developments in this industry, and specifically warehousing, distribution, e-commerce?
Yeah. I've recently came across a very interesting report by Gartner. And so if you look at it, one of the examples that we can always take from is the record player sales. you know, the record player, the vinyls and all that. So many years ago, back in the 78s, back in the 70s, right? 1978, 1980s, record player sales, like one of the highest ever in history. I think it recorded about $3 billion US dollars. And then if you look at it in the 90s, this peak 3 billion dollars plummeted 80% to $500 million only. Because why? Consumers move to cassette tapes and then CDs, right? And then you get a genius called Steve Jobs comes up and say, hey, the iPod. And then that's where I think all of us experience the rise and fall of the whole vinyl, cassette tapes and CDs. And I think it teaches us a very important lesson for supply chain. And I think that the key moral of a story, the key lesson here is making supply chain investments, such as factory capacity or inventory from historical performance. That means looking back rather than understanding future trends is actually a disaster. Yeah. So let me just break it down in a more simple manner for us to understand. If you look at, for example, tech, right? I think everybody in a supply chain logistics space knows that the one key factor, the one key game changer, right? That key thing that could be a game changer to the space, to the business is actually tech. However, when it comes to tech, it's also the question of investment also come together, right? So when you invest in tech, what are you doing? Are you investing in tech to cure something, to basically plug a limitation? Mm-hmm. Or are you investing in tech to not only plug a limitation, but to also try to move, future-proof the business? Yeah. And that's what I mean, is instead of investing into it or investing into your supply chain and says that, hey, look, from what's been happening, rather look at it from the future trends of what's going to happen, e-commerce, distribution, network distribution. And if you ask me, the path of the music industry shows very clearly the importance of a 10-year plan. So if I look at it today, what has been changing really, of course, very easily put it out there is what has really changed is e-commerce, right? E-commerce has really took an uprise trend and it's definitely going to go up more and more. What has driven, I think what has happened over the last 20 months for e-commerce in the e-commerce space is basically the last 20 months of the COVID-19 and lockdown in many nations has basically molded a behavior in consumer buying. If the lockdown only happens for 2 months, maybe people will say, okay, you know what? Now we can all go back to the shopping malls. Let's forget about e-commerce, right? We can go to the mall and get it. We can still feel and touch. But today, because it's 20 months and it's no joke, 20 months locking down at home and having to see the last mile delivery guys from the Grab guys and the Food Pandas showing up at your house, delivering your parcels. I think that's and when it happens for 20 months, it becomes a habit. You know what people say? It takes 14 days to develop a habit. I think 20 months is really enough for us to develop a habit, right? And the retail guys knows this. The retail brands knows this, which is why a lot of retail brands today that we're working with as well, with in Hatio, is the retail brands are coming to us and say, hey, look, we have brick and mortar. We used to have 50 retail outlets. Today, we are down to 20. We have cut out 30. But even with these 20, as the economy opens up, we would like to, we are really seriously considering moving our retail play into an omni-channel. Yeah. Right, the experience has got to be omnichannel. It's not to say, okay, let's tone down e-commerce since the shopping malls are opening up and let's just keep focusing on the shopping malls. But no, they know that the consumer behavior has changed and it has changed forever. So now the whole idea is, so how do you then blend into that experience and provide the consumers a better buying experience? So that's where a lot of retail plays are moving into omnichannel. So that's basically one, right? The other one that I also see, the second thing that we have been observing is that machines are getting more and more intelligent. Machines are getting more and more intelligent. Even the most recent Gartner report, right, forecast predicts that artificial intelligence will create $5 trillion of business value by 2025. Now, 2025 is 3 years from now, right? Wow.
Yeah.
2025 is not too long. Now, having said this, and I also believe that having said this, in my opinion, is that the potential, the full potential of artificial intelligence, AI, is still very much yet to be, desired for. It has not like fully arrived yet. So I think that this is changing very rapidly, we work with a lot of e-commerce merchants, the medium and the large size guys. And even right now, these e-commerce merchants, which is the sellers, not just selling over marketplaces, multiple marketplaces, the language has changed. Over the years, the language has changed. The language is now, the e-commerce merchants are saying, with the data that we are getting, with the consumer data that we're getting, the phone, not only the phone numbers, so they're not only looking from marketing perspective, the postcodes, people are now talking about postcodes, the location that they're in, the average buying price, average order in a cart. How can we make sense of all these things? What is the market telling me? What is all this data telling me? So now, and that's what we're doing, right? We are basically layering a business intelligence. We're basically layering AI, an AI layer technology on top of what we're doing. And to basically now advise, or rather give this as a value add to our clients and say, hey, look, this is how your market is moving. This is where people are buying. This is where your focus market is. Double down on this, right? On this segment and stuff like that, right? So that's number two, right? Machines are very intelligent. Now, number three that we are definitely very obvious and we are really looking at is the ecosystem. It's become an ecosystem play, and the ecosystem is getting more and more connected. While the machines are getting more and more intelligent, now what we're seeing is that everything is getting connected, right? The ecosystem is getting more and more connected. It used to be many years ago, it used to be in Lazada and Shopee. Let's just take, for example, in Lazada and Shopee, the marketplaces, a seller can be basically selling over these two marketplaces, two stores each, and they are manually managing the orders. So they have to log in Lazada, and then when they want to get the orders from Shopee, they basically log in Shopee. So it's like a login, logout, very manual. And it's okay, it's okay. So long as they get the orders, so long as sales comes in. But today, things are different. Today, these marketplaces are all connected into a, for example, like what we're doing, right? The cloud supply chain platform. So these marketplaces are connected. This platform is also connected to the back office, which is the accounting systems. Yeah. So then the whole workflow become very seamless. Data is moving in and out of the cloud, and we assess it through our mobile devices. So you got to enable mobile devices within the operations. And this is where I think it's getting more and more obvious. And I guess these are the three key factors that is going to be moving and driving the entire logistics and supply chain game moving forward in the next, I don't know. Yeah. So looking back at 10 years, what's happening? And then of course, looking at the future trends, I think this is what's going to really be the key driver of it. Yeah.
Very interesting. Yeah. Exciting, but also challenging. And you have to be really on top of it and be know what is trying to predict what is happening and adapt to it.
Yeah, and we haven't even touched things like, and it's something that's been happening. It's not even new anymore. You can't even say that this is new anymore, which is the social media, what they call it, the social commerce, the social selling. How I've always, and I'm still very amazed with the whole fact of, and it's like entertainment, right? When you go to, was it Taobao or something like that? And you see how these China sellers sell over Facebook.
Yeah.
And this is no joke, man. I've just about 2 months back, my wife was showing me how a seller in China sold $100,000 watch over a Facebook Live. And guess what? Sold out.
Wow.
In less than 30 minutes, sold out. Yeah. And that's people buy that, people are purchasing at that kind of value over the Facebook Live. Yeah. And that only tells you how fast and how far this thing is going to go in terms of,
but also that good sales technique is still relevant.
Yeah, it's always putting the pretty face in front of the camera and that kind of the different kind of way or approach of talking conversations. But yeah, I guess it's going to be very interesting to see how it's going to be like moving forward.
Yeah. So you have a lot of experience moving around in Asia that includes Malaysia, Korea, China. Yeah, what is your doing business there? What is your experience so far in these different countries?
Good question. I think because personally for me, I've also learned over time as I traveled these countries that I love culture and I love to immerse myself in people's culture, right? To the extent, Choi, that when I bring my family out for holidays, we are not the holiday maker kind of type where we will go to a country and then we'll go for a week or 10 days and then we play tourist, go on a tour agency, on a tour bus kind of thing. We don't do that. We basically say, okay, let's make time 1 month out, and we don't stay in hotels. We don't go and stay in Gangnam when we're in Korea. We will stay out somewhere in where there's all locals. And when we're there, we're like a rare sight for the locals. We're like, why aren't you? You know, it's like the locals will ask, why aren't you guys in the hotel in Gangnam, right? Why are you here? Why are you here in Airbnb in one of the houses? And I think that's where really, that's where it makes, and I think I'm very curious in terms of that, right? So that drives, and that basically gives me that experience every time when I visit. Of course, sometimes you visit for holiday and sometimes you visit for business. So when I visit for business, my experience is that it's about understanding people's culture, and it's about also learning how to respect, learning the word of respect. Because one of the things I learned when I'm in Korea, or when I'm in Vietnam, when I'm in Singapore, the more advanced nation, when I'm in Philippines, different every time I go there. Of course, because I'm very Southeast Asian look, I'm like fully Asian look, right? People have told me before, Bernard, when you go to Thailand, I think the Thais won't have problem with you because you look like one of them. And then when you go to Vietnam, and then when the moment you go and walk into a restaurant and it says Xin Chao, and you're like, oh, you sound like a Vietnamese. Mm. So you wouldn't have much problem, you know, blending in with these guys. Yes. So I think that's an advantage for me, right, personally. And then I learned that respect is also very different. Respect is not a one-size-fits-all when you go to all these countries. And doing business in these countries, in different markets like that, requires me to like a chameleon, right? When you are in this market, in this country, in this culture, all right, yeah, then you got to blend in with the culture. And then, so I find that it's very important. It's key to be able to adapt when you travel around. It's key to be authentic, to be real. And you don't have to be like, I'm there when I'm in Korea, and because I'm in Korea, okay, give you an example. When I'm in Korea, I want to do business with the Hyundai guys. And when I meet the Hyundai guys, oh, Korea people like barbecue and soju. Okay, that means you must talk over barbecue, and because this is what I see over the Korean dramas in Netflix. It is actually really not the case. So when you take time to understand people's culture, you start to realize that soju and barbecue actually meant something else. Soju and barbecue is not the first go-to point if you want to establish that relationship. Soju and barbecue is only when you build that trust and enough for you to have a soju and barbecue in front with the other Korean guy that you just met 2 hours ago or a day ago. And even and I learned this a lot in Korea because I spent a lot of time in Korea. Even right down to when the soju is served to you, how do you then take that bottle and pour it back? And when you drink, if it's an elder, it's a more elder guy in front of you, how you turn left or turn. And these are small little things that matters, but you don't want to be learning these things and doing it because you want to do business with that guy. You want to be really understanding the culture, why people do it that way, so that it's not just about blending in, but it's about understanding that culture so that you can learn how to respect people when you're there.
Wow. Okay.
And I think this plays a very important role. A lot of people, I do see a lot of business people getting it all wrong. We go to Vietnam, we need to go and bring these guys we need to be able to sit at the very, you know, that low stool at the side of the road in downtown district one and drink beer. It's not that, right? You know, a lot of things that I find, and I always say this as a joke to a lot of my business friends. I say, hey guys, look, when you go to other people's country, never think that drinking is the first port of call. Drinking is never the first point of call. Drinking is only when those guys trust you enough and bring you out. Else, talk business. And it's important to learn that. I feel what I've really learned over the years of traveling so much across these countries is that you got to really learn how to respect people's culture. And you have to go from that point of view.
Lessons. This is what I hear indeed. You're very subtle and you're observing, and you're basically not really focused on business or doing a quick deal, but really trying to understand how to show respect, basically.
So if I may just add to this, and I think it's important, is one of the things that I've learned over the so many years since. Actually, one of the things that I've learned since I was 17 is three things. First, number one is empathy. It's not about, like you mentioned, right? It's not about going in just because you have something to sell. Empathy works. And I'm not sure about the others, but to me personally, empathy, being able to empathize works perfectly well even when you try to sell a software. So what I'm trying to say here is when what I do in my day-to-day sales, right, is every time I walk into a sales meeting, even if it's the first time seeing a new client, I will never take out my laptops. How we work in a sales meeting and the first thing we do is always take out laptops, the HDMI cable, look for the projector, how do we plug on and make sure that it works fine because you don't want technical glitch, and technical glitch will always happen. What I do is, and here's what I do, I will not bring out my laptop. I will just keep my laptop in the back. I will, most of the most, I'll just bring out my oh yeah, this notebook.
Notebook, yeah.
And I will always use a red color pen. Always use a red color pen. And I always put it on a table. And I will spend, if that meeting is 1 hour, I will spend 45 minutes just trying to understand and creating conversations with the other party. And it's about, okay, yeah, what is the market like? What are your challenges? Why is it like that? And then I love the whiteboards because the whiteboards allow me to illustrate whatever that he's saying. So I'm like the artist. Okay, I'll keep on talking and then I'll draw. Okay, so this is my warehouse. This is the problem. This is the channels that I saw I'm selling in and blah, blah, blah. And this is my back office. This is how operations is working. Then I say, okay, where's the problem? And then, okay, where's the problem? I'll write down where's the problem. This is empathy. This is empathy in play, empathy in action. And then after that 45 minutes, my record is I've closed more deals, not even showing a demo. I don't even bring out my laptop. I was just okay like that. Okay, then the last 15 minutes will be they then start. I will always bring them, try to bring them to the point where they are the one that ask me, so Bernard,
curious, yeah,
interesting, what can you do for us? Because when they ask that questions, they are open up, they're ready to listen. Even if you're going to talk for the next 3 hours, you are rest assured you have their ears.
Yeah, but
if you go in and start, hey, this is my product, this is what Hatio is, this is my background, I think I'm not sure about the other side, but for me, if I empathize, I put myself on that fella's shoes, I think you lost me in the next 4 minutes. Mm. In the first 4 minutes, you probably lost me. Okay, come on, what else? Come on, show me. Okay, you're not that relevant. So when I do that, I find it's very important. So first, empathy. It becomes so important to be able to empathize. Number two is, over the years, what I've learned is people. And when I talk about people, it's really about not, you know, learning, and I'm still learning till today, is to learn not to judge people and to be able to drive people through empowerment, not limitations. Everybody will come with limitations, but it's to being able as a leader to drive people's beliefs through empowerment. And because it's through empowerment and those beliefs that it drives the actions and how they're going to respond to you as well. Those are actions, right? So especially in our culture, it's always, I was just having a lunch discussion with one of my engineers yesterday. He's having a little bit of issues and troubles of back home but then as we talk and he's sharing with me how toxic the environment in where his wife is working, right? And then I'll ask, oh, so how is it like in Hatio? How is it like back in the office? Are you happy? Right? And he says, yeah, this is like the perfect. And he scores the working environment here 15 out of 10. I was like, wow, okay, that's a little bit overwhelming. But then I asked why. And really, one of the things that I found out why he was happy and he says this was because there was no toxic environment. And it's the culture. And when it's where you, and I guess it's important, and this is where it's driven when you continue to empower people. Don't judge people's beliefs because it's their beliefs, whether they're making this decision or that decision, left or right, whether they go left or go, it's their beliefs that bring them there. So don't judge. Keep on empowering them whether they're going left or right. So that's the second thing. And the third thing, which is the most important that I've learned all this while, and is relationship, right? So first is empathy, people. And the third most important thing is relationship. And we have this hashtag. We have this hashtag back in the office, and we will always flash this hashtag everywhere around, which is called Relationship Matters. With my co-founders, every time I get into a new business or every time I go into a new venture, and I always tell my co-founders this, I say, guys, business is not a sure win. If it's a sure win, we wouldn't all be sitting here today. It's not a sure win. Some point or other, we will have challenges. There'll be ups and downs. And it could also be that this business, I even tell my founders, co-founders in Hatio, right? I say, look, guys, Hatio could be also a business that's not going to work out 3 years from now or 4 years from now. But yeah. Hey, look, guys, when the business doesn't work out, the friendship must stay. So it's always the friendship prioritized, or the relationship must be the priority over the business. Well, it's a very subjective matter, right? There can be a lot of argument and debates over this. But personally, my thinking is when you put relationship above the business, right, you will then eventually, over time, you build a lot of trust. And at the end of the day, just ask ourselves, right? And I always ask myself, at the end of the day, what matters?
Yeah.
The business? The profits? Really? Okay, that matters. That gives you your Ferraris and whatnot. But at the end of the day, when you reach the end point, the end game of your life, what matters is, and I always remember my grandfather teaching me this, or telling me this, asking me this question. Bernard, at the end of the day, at the end game, can you count 5 friends in your one hand? Can you actually name 5 friends in the first, in one hand, in 5 fingers, right? Because if you can do that, you have lived a life well lived.
Wow.
And it's not easy. It's not easy to actually count. It's like, I got a lot of friends. Facebook, I got 2,700 friends. That's Facebook. But how many friends can you go through life with and journey together? So relationship becomes so important. And we actually drill this, Choi, we actually drill this down in our business, in Hatio, where from our sales guys to our onboarding customer experience guys to our engineers, even our engineers who are so rarely interfacing with our clients, we even tell them, look, relationship matters. I remember telling because one of the process that we have is after our clients subscribe to our cloud supply chain platform, it's a training, right? So every time I always tell the customer experience, the onboarding team, I say, look, guys, when you go in and do the training, never go in and immediately take out your laptop, plug it in and say, okay, there's 10 chapters in today's training. And I said, no, don't do that. First thing, go in, ask, hey, how's your kid doing? How's your morning? How was, you know, yeah. Get personal.
The human aspect,
it makes all the difference. I say, when you get personal first, the training becomes easier.
Yeah.
So even though you make mistakes in the training, people will forgive you easier. But if you go in straight and, okay, let's talk business. I say, you got to be really good in that. If not, if you're not, then get personal first. Build the relationship and focus on human, the human side of things. So 3 things, right? Empathy, people, and relationship.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, I think that's really what matters.
Yeah. Wow. And so great also that you are, leading people in this way and also telling you people in your organization about these lessons and how they should get along with each other. That's really amazing. I can understand that your engineer is giving you 15 out of 10 in that respect.
Yeah, I was so happy that I actually bought him lunch. But when he said, no, yeah, don't worry, you know, because we were talking so much about how toxic the environment where his wife was working in.
Yeah.
And the wife was like crying every night because especially when you're locked down and blah, blah, blah. Yes. And I was worried because at home, he was already exposed to this energy, this kind of negative vibe. So I was like, okay, holy cow. I said, okay. So what about, let's talk about you. How about the office? Are you happy? My first question, are you happy? No, it's different here. I say it's different. Here's all about people, and it's very different. And it, because it comes from an engineer, it means a lot. It doesn't come from the sales guy, because the sales guy is always talking marketing. He's always talking sales.
Yeah, he knows what talker. To say. Yeah, that's true.
Correct.
The engineer is more true, especially with regards to his feelings.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
But it's great because he will have energy to help and support his wife back home because he is a happy man. So.
Hopefully.
Yeah, that's great.
That's right.
You gave us an anecdote about your grandfather and also about the man in your neighborhood. Yeah, I wanted to ask you, who inspired you? Is it, have we covered it already, or someone else comes in?
Well, I'll just touch on this very quickly. It's very difficult, I think, for me to answer this, who inspired you, right? I think, first of all, my situation inspired me, or rather motivate me to drive and keep driving. I didn't come from a rich family. Of course, I'm blessed that I didn't come from a broken family. However, I came from a very typical Asian parents. A very typical Asian parents. You don't talk about financial goals. It's always I say you, don't argue, that kind of thing. It's study very hard, get yourself to the universities and graduate and become the Asian parent dilemma, lawyer, engineer, or doctor. I didn't land on any of these 3. Being the rebellious kid that I am, it was really the situation that I saw, that I was experiencing as a child during my childhood. It's not a bad thing. It's just that I look at it and I say, hey, look, how can I break this? how can I break this vicious cycle? How can I break this cycle off? Because when I look back, and there weren't any entrepreneurs, there weren't business people. They were all very hardworking people. They work 9 to 5 on shifts. Holidays are really 3 days, 2 nights. You're very lucky to get a 3 days, 2 nights, that kind of thing. And they live paychecks to paychecks. Again, nothing wrong. I'm not being judgmental. Nothing wrong with that. But when I look at it, when I was still rather young, I look at it and say, it comes to a point when I was 18, 19, and it's like the kind of point in time when it hits you and it's like, what's next? And that's where I thought, okay, I might not know what's next, but what I do know is I would love to give it a shot to see if I can break this vicious cycle. Because I don't come from a big family, small family, even with my cousins, we're just like 5 of us. So if I'm the eldest. So if whatever that I do, and that time I told myself, whatever that I do and whatever going to happen next is going to influence the younger ones. So that's how I look at it. And I just wanted to break that vicious cycle. That was what inspired or basically drove me. Now, over time, and now, this question of who inspired me becomes more prevalent because... And I think I can answer this right now in this current situation, right now. So back then was back then. So now, the one key person that really inspires me now is my wife.
Mm.
Not because she's my wife, but because of the way she drives herself. And the way she took the leap of faith in everything that we do. On the front, so on podcasts like that, I'm the spokesperson, right? Mm. On the front, it's you, the brand, right? Yeah, Bernard is the hero. But really, the true hero here really is, and this is not a dedication to my wife, but this is really what I feel every day.
Yeah, what you observe, what you have experienced.
Correct. Correct. Because I observe the way she manages the stress. I observe the way she handles it and observe the way, and I love it, particularly the way she compliments not only me, but the entire team of co-founders. Because it's like, most of us are guys. So it's, sometimes you just need that lady effect. And she manages it so well.
Yeah.
So with the way she manages it and she handles the situation, that is one thing that really inspires me to say, get up and run. Run harder and faster, because look, there's nothing else that you need. It's like there's nothing else that you need to worry, but all the key critical points, whether it's home and if you look at the way she juggles between the home and the office, it's amazing. I can't even imagine myself doing that to that level.
You know?
And she can do it. And with the kids, with the in-laws, I would have given up. Like, okay.
Wow, it's really great that you see that and that you admire it and that you see your wife with who you are together for a long time already, that you keep on also changing yourself and that you keep on seeing also skills and the way she handles it, that mm-hmm. you can appreciate mm-hmm. that. So you basically, you get the best out of each other also, and it's benefiting you as a team. So
yeah,
that is really amazing.
So yeah, she inspires me.
Wow.
Every day. Yeah, every day.
That sounds awesome. Yeah. Hey, yeah. And looking back, what would you advise your younger self?
Learn how to slow down, Bennett. Learn how to slow down and pace it. Although I would also say at the same time that if I were to be 10 years younger, or maybe 20 years younger, my younger self today, and if that advice comes in, I probably wouldn't hear it.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't take it. Right? Because when you are your early 20s, I mean, nothing to lose. It's like everybody's telling you the world is your oyster. How to slow down? But really, if there's one piece of advice that I would advise my younger self, would be slow down. Learn how to slow down at certain points. Pick your battles. Don't have to fight every battle. Some battles are just, what I've learned over time is that 70%, 80% of the time, these battles are just let it go. It's fine. Choose that 20% of the battle to fight and win. And pace yourself out, because if you don't do that, you get burnt out very easily. You get burnt out very easily, and you probably wouldn't survive so far. You know, I think I was lucky because I met my wife 11, 12 years ago. And ever since the day one I met her, we were already on this together. So we like able to share that burnout load together. So when she's burnt out, I come in. And when I'm burnt out, most of the time she comes in. So I was lucky that. But if you're a lone founder, you're out there, you probably just want to learn how to slow down when you're younger days. Pace it out.
Yeah.
Choose the battles. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Good advice. And looking at the future, 10 years from now, What are you doing then?
10 years from now, Zachary will be 17 years old. Thaddeus will be 15. They probably at their most rebellious teenage years. And that's where I, number one, I don't see myself stopping 10 years from now. If it's 10 years, I don't see myself stopping yet. I wouldn't want to say anything about early retirement and all that bullshit. But if my kids at 10 years from now, if my kids are at that point of time, I would love to be able to be there, to journey through that phase. That 16-year-old to 19-year-old, anything can go wrong.
Yeah,
in a phase. Very crucial. We were lucky to make it out alive and still standing here. But I would really want to be able to work. So one of the shared goals that my wife and I had is to really be able to build ourselves, work very hard right now, build ourselves so that the next 8 to 10 years from now, we are able to say that we can be there for our kids, for our teenagers, and to help them and to guide them, not help them, but to guide them through that critical phase.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's where I want to be. I don't want to just have that thing about, oh, 10 years from now, I'm going to be the unicorn. I'm going to be IPO in NASDAQ and all that. If that happens, all well and good. But I think there's more to life than just that, than just to be a unicorn, than just to be really successful in business.
Yeah.
That, to me, is a bonus. But what's more important is to always understand that there's more to life than just this.
Right? Why are you doing it? Why are you really doing it? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah.
I think that's a great goal to be realizing, like, okay, the boys will need us by then.
Yeah.
Because it's a difficult transition they will make in life. And it will influence them also for the rest of their journey. And I want to be there for them energy-wise, time-wise. Yeah, that is really a great thought, and that you and your wife have this as a goal. It's that will definitely help you, actually, I think, to propel your business even further. So Bernard, it's been amazing to hear your thoughts and that you share your journey with us. I've learned so much just me already. That's really great. We covered a lot. Is there anything else that you want to share with us?
Do we still have another 6 hours to go? No.
You should write a book.
Maybe when I one day can fly to the moon, Richard Branson style. When I reach that stage, then maybe a book would.
No, I don't think you have to wait until that phase, because you see things very clearly and very crisp, and you can relate to, I think, a younger generation out there that really feels more related.
I think to your question, I think just one very quick one, which is, and this is something that I very rarely talk about, but over the years, especially recent years, especially over the last 20 months, and it's really been one very key, crucial thing that has helped me personally, especially, is for the younger listeners, and you are hustling it out there. Some days are good, most days are bad. Let's just accept it. Most days are bad, down looking, some days are good. Is to get a coach. Get a coach that is reeling. And I was lucky. I'm very lucky. My wife and I were very lucky to have met and built this very strong relationship with both our coaches, who is willing to, Bernard, call me anytime. Right, it's like hotline. So we have them on our speed dials, and at any one point in time, not only about business decisions, not only about sales, go to market, but sometimes it's also really about. I remember just calling up and say, hey, look, I'm just pretty stressed with what's happening with some people in the office. What should I do, and how to manage even right now the relationships? Yeah, get a coach.
Where to find one?
I don't know. To be honest, I don't know. There's just so many out there. In my LinkedIn, every week, there's two people trying to sell me their coaching services.
Oh, yeah, you mean a professional?
Correct. But the way I found my coach wasn't through that. I do not know. I'm not sure whether I should say I found him or he found me. But it just happened. And we continue to build on the relationship. And today we have a very strong relationship. And it's the guy, the person, that your confidante, that you can speak almost about anything. And he's not there to tell you what to do. I've always say this to my coach. I say, coach, look, I mean, I call him coach, right? I say, coach, look, I know I'm going to ask you this question and you're probably going to give me back in 10 different questions. And I think that's what makes a good coach, right? He don't tell you what to do. No solutions. but a question is going to be responded by 10 different questions. Now go think for yourself. Go decide whatever that's, yeah. And you're not being judged. So I think it's important. I know it's a bit random here. I kind of thought that it's worth to share something that's really helped us go through one of the toughest times that we've had. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a great tip. Yeah. Yeah. So, how can people reach out to you? You're this inspiring story. I can imagine. Are you open to that?
Obviously, I love conversations, as you can see by now. You can find me on LinkedIn, Bernard Hoar. I'm on Facebook as well, same Bernard Hoar. Yeah, I'm actually very reachable. Or you can just drop me my email, personal email, bernardhoar@gmail.com. And yeah, I'll be happy to really talk about anything. Yeah, yeah. About life. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I'm a fan. Thank you very much for your time and sharing this.
Likewise, I really love this conversation. One of the best podcasts, Joy. One of the best.
Yeah.
Very easygoing and wisdom. Very insightful.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for talking to me as well. Too.